This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Today I'm going to have a special multi-featured, multi-guest honorarium for Gerard Holmgren, who was a quite brilliant Australian investigator of 9/11, among the first, if not the first, to recognize that no planes may have been involved in the events of 9/11. My first guest today, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show, is Morgan Reynolds, well known to this audience, and a recent beneficiary of more than a quadruple bypass. I'm delighted he's here with us. He just came from playing tennis today. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jim. Great to be back. And this is a wonderful occasion, and I'm so glad you've done this, to have a radio interview show as a tribute to the work of Gerard Holmgren, who passed away of cancer on May 2nd, a month ago, 2010. I have a few bio facts that your subsequent guests, especially Rosalie, may be able to fill out further, but Gerard was born on November 11, 1958, so he was age 51. He died in Sydney, Australia. And I want the way I found out was a childhood friend sent me an email on May 6th, and I'd like to read that email, if it's all right.
Certainly.
It gives us a great introduction to Gerard the man. And the email is from Stuart West from Perth in Western Australia. And he writes, "I am not a 9/11 truther or anything like that. I have been browsing through some of Gerard Holmgren, born Gerald Holmgren, associated stuff on 9/11 and came across your site, which is nomoregames.net. Just thought you should know he passed away on Sunday morning, May 2 at 7:30 a.m. at Canterbury Hospital, Sydney, Australia. I was his friend since childhood, and I was there in his last few days. He was diagnosed with inoperable cancer right out of the blue just a week before his death. Bad luck for a guy who never smoked a single cigarette, joint, or took any sort of drug except very moderate alcohol consumption in his life. I can see he gave you a hard time there on your 9/11 position. Paren, same damn position as his, as far as I can make out." Close paren. His friends all knew he could put up a feisty argument, especially if one had not thought through one's argument all that well beforehand. But I thought you should also know behind the debate and the argumentative exterior, he was really a lovely, gentle guy. He just loved a good debate, and he was usually rather well-read. And I commend you for putting both your and his side of your exchanges in that essay where you discuss your, quote, estrangement, unquote, from each other, if I may put it that way. Well, anyway, his funeral was held today. That was May 6th. If you have a Facebook account, you can look it up under Gerard Holmgren, rest in peace. He was surrounded by friends, fellow musicians. Paren, he was a damn fine blues and jazz guitarist, close quote, and students. I met some of these people. You see, Gerard and I are originally from Western Australia, not Sydney, which is in the east. And they are fine people, humble people, decent folk, caring folk, not at all puffed up or overly proud. The 3 days I spent in Sydney with Gerard before he passed away were a revelation. Well, I've been reading some of your material, and I hope to read more, having bookmarked your website. That photo of the plane going into the tower seamlessly is an eye-opener. So that is all from me. Maybe it is time for folks to calm down a bit and be a bit more forgiving of each other. I sense that attitude in your writing, and that is why I took the time to send you this message and let you know about Gerard Paren Gerald. Close paren. Best regards, Stuart West, Perth, Western Australia. Now, that's a lovely email and a tribute to Gerard. Of course, it doesn't get very far into the specifics of his intellectual contribution, which is enormous. I mean, Girard would argue has got to be in anybody's top three in 9/11 researchers. And although Rosalie may be able to correct me later, but Thierry Masson in October 2001, within a month, had put out something on a website about, hey, there's no plane at the Pentagon. And then his book in French came out in March of 2002. Rosalie was the first American no-planer and probably the first on the World Trade Center hoax, plane hoax. And then Girard was very early on in 2002, I think. And he had, of course, a few dozen at least analytical pieces on his website, which he took down around 2006 in disgust, but fortunately Rosalie had those backed up and they're available on her website, The Web Theory. So there's my thumbnail sketch of some of the main points to bring out about Girard Holmgren.
Very nice, Morgan. What do you take to be among his most important arguments in relation to no planes?
Well, before I go there, let me point out that, as you pointed out, Girard was a brilliant researcher, writer, student of the 9/11 event, and he was a brilliant teacher. You can see that, you know, as a guitar instructor or whatever he was going to teach. He was a man after my own heart in that keep it simple, stupid, right? And he could really write and argue extremely well. And he was he also had a sly sense of humor. That's what allowed him to do these parodies. Like one of his pieces, his well-known pieces, and I don't have the title list here, but what it was basically about foolish conspiracy theories. And he put the official theory through that lens. You know, how stupid, crazy thing, can people believe this? You know, a guy in a cave in Afghanistan on a dialysis machine? And he went on and on and just... And he had other pieces like that basically kind of the roadrunner, you know, how can you penetrate this thing and then on the other side fall into pieces. So it was the illogic. And he seemed, he was interested in the human aspect of 9/11. He was brilliant, for example, in taking apart eyewitness testimony in one very extended piece, as well as the simple physics of no planes and how impossible the official story is to believe. And now, later on, of course, now early on, I came into the party late, and I think that I'm reading this into Girard, but I think that bothered him because, you know, I had credentials. I was probably going to be a visible participant in this whole 9/11. But I came in with this article on June 9th, 2005 that caught a lot of attention. And for a while, we were very close. I would run things by him, and he would give his advice, and it was usually moderate and well to heed his advice. But later on, there was a falling out. And Girard, you know, here's another characteristic. Not only was he brilliant and acerbic, he was a man of fierce determination. And I'm not going to back down, you know. I won't back down. That's a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers song. And that could be one of his theme songs. But another aspect of it, of his character, was purity. Absolute purity. Whereas I'm less than absolute pure in that my whole approach to this has been that truth is our weapon, but I've been pursuing justice. I want to see convictions of real live proofs, and I can't do that alone. Whereas by the end, when Gerard quit the 9/11 industry, he seemed to be isolated and alone. In other words, he cut off relations with previous colleagues like Nicol Hawk and Rosalie Grable. So that's kind of similar to what Eric Hushman, I don't think he has any friends in 9/11 research and propaganda either. So how can you win like that? You got to have a little bit of a gift. It's like living in a an academic department like you and I have, and you got to be a little more tolerant, not jump down everybody's throat who isn't following your exact procedure, and allow that in the longer run things are going to settle out and the truth is going to emerge very strongly.
Well, I think those are very fine remarks, Morgan. Gerard seems to me to have been quite strong on explaining why they didn't use planes, and I know this is a matter to which you've given substantial thought. It would be very useful, I think, for the audience to appreciate why it would be better, if you were planning an event of this kind, to not use actual physical aircraft, but rather some form of video fakery.
Right. Yeah, there are a lot of things that don't allow the planes to be your best option. One of them is it's not going to have the if you use real planes flying them into the towers, assuming you could do it, first of all, it's not going to have the shock and awe effect you're looking for. Because the plane is just going to be in pieces, okay? It's not going to set up the big disintegration and the jet fuel fire. It's just going to be bouncing off the building in a ball of fire. And so that's not the effect they were looking for. But there are so many things that can go wrong, of course. This way, you don't need a stand-down order because you don't, while you might have some radar inserts or blips to pretend that there are planes out there, planes intercepts were scrambled, they're not going to find anything. So that eliminates this whole 2 hours of non-defense by our fine number one Air Force and National Guard, etc. And then you have the problem, of course, of missing the buildings. John Lear is eloquent on that, but Gerard, too. Kill Count had an article about why they didn't use planes that summed up a lot of this as well. But there are too many things that can go wrong. And of course, if a plane were to crash somewhere else, in a real plane, they'd find, gee whiz, well, not only were there no Arab names on manifest, but there aren't any Arab hijackers either, and on. So the whole thing, it's a mind-boggling thing. It's very. I go back to the Bush statement a couple months after 9/11, before the UN, where he said, "Let us not entertain outrageous conspiracy theories." You know, that takes the onus off the real perpetrators. Well, I agree, but this whole attack was so brilliant that. With the very important aid of the complicit mainstream media, they made it hard for the pursuers like us to get very far because they did it in an incredible way. A lot of people can't believe, and most 9/11 researchers fight this all the way, Gerard's pioneering work. They don't believe that there were no planes, and therefore no plane crashes. So, and yet the logic, as Gerard laid it out, is impeccable. As everything he did, really, maybe aside from toward the end when he was angry at everybody. His articles for years were extremely powerful and highly resisted, to no good effect, in my opinion. The guy was powerful. Early on, I saw, hey, this guy, let's look across the valley and see where we're headed down the road years from now. And this guy is going to be recognized as a powerful pioneer researcher on 9/11.
You know, it's very interesting, Morgan, that my first encounters with Gerard had to do with having founded Scholars in December of 2005 and invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair, which was, by the way, at the recommendation of David Ray Griffin. I found almost immediately that Jones was being besieged by Holmgren. And I, not knowing Holmgren or the background here, went to the defense of Steve, and I actually composed numerous rebuttals to Gerard in relation to his attacks on Steve, where now I wonder if I had only known more about the context and the facts of the matter and so forth, I mightn't have been more receptive to Gerard's critique.
Yeah, I was looking at that yesterday or the day before where Gerard did this open letter to Professor Stephen Jones when Jones first caught attention. I believe it was in September, of 05, was it?
Yeah.
It was a very politely, cleverly drafted letter that Gerard said, basically, we don't disagree on the demolition issue, that the buildings were imploded somehow or other. That's a given, and it wasn't jet fuel. But he criticized, he brought up, after some very polite, flattering statements, Jones got the plane model wrong that were alleged to have flown into the two Twin Towers, which was supposed to be officially a 767, but Jones called it a 757. And Jones claimed that he had gone out and inspected the undercarriage. And he had this throwaway statement basically tanning the no-plane theory. And yet, basically, Gerard turned Jones's statements, diffident statements about the Wright hypothesis, what was the more plausible hypothesis about the destruction of the World Trade Center, against Jones, where Jones had prejudged, mistakenly, in my view, the plane-no-plane controversy. So right away, Gerard's antenna were right about him. Although by the end, it seemed like Gerard had extended his antenna so that everybody virtually, Reynolds and Fetzer, of course he took a dislike to Fetzer right away, but it took a little longer for him to turn against the Webb Ferry and Reynolds and Nickel, et cetera. But by the end, of course, Gerard withdrew, as I said, in disgust.
Of course, it took you, I don't know, 18 months to 2 years to get me to become open-minded about no planes, Morgan. So, I mean, Gerard must have had, here I was on the one hand defending Steve Jones from Gerard's attacks. On the other, I wasn't being receptive to no planes. So it must have been a double whammy.
Well, it's interesting our history there. Because you took a stand against me and brought up Zeno's paradox or something. You didn't have a real reason, and I thought, geez, although I didn't bring it to your attention, I would bemoan it to Dr. Judy Wood, because we talked for years every day. And basically I said, Jim's not being scholarly. There's no reason for him to take a position on this issue that he hasn't investigated.
Yeah.
So now you admit, it took you a couple of years before you started looking at it and treating it seriously, and then you changed your mind, which
Absolutely.
Is to your credit.
Yeah. And you were instrumental, Morgan. You were instrumental. If you hadn't kept clubbing me over the head about taking a look, you know, and getting serious about the evidence, who knows when I would have got to it, because it just seemed to me on the face of it so implausible. And yet today I realize, my God, knowing what I know now, it's over not merely plausible and overwhelmingly probable, but I say demonstrable.
Yeah, you know, here again, we all have to wonder about each other's motives, but we do need Gerard's close friend, Stuart West, put it, what did he say, be a bit more forgiving of each other,
yes.
Calm down a bit, and that's very, very true. Now, Gerard, you can see in the clips where he's playing guitar, He has a very calm, he has a calmness about it, you know. He's playing rockabilly, but I would be just, if I could play guitar like he could, you know, I would be in motion, I guess, and excited about it, whereas he is very concentrated, and you can see there's a certain fierceness or determination about him. Here again, he would be like on the tennis court, very competitive guy, right? And he, I think, you know, given these characteristics, he just had a burnout. I'm just drawing a parallel between you and me. And you just basically have to be in it, I would argue, for the long run, and give people a break, you know. Like, even though you aren't 100% convinced somebody is genuine, be sympathetic and give them a break. And,
yes.
We need to have these kind of friction reducers because... And not throw anybody out of the club on a moment's kind of impurity or whatever.
Yes.
People have mistaken judgments, and as long as they're still people of goodwill, they might come around. So, you know, leave the door open unless you're really convinced they are malintended.
I mean, Morgan, if it took me, a year and a half or more to come around and become open-minded about the possibility, the mere possibility, you know, planes, I wonder where I stood in the eyes of some of you who saw it all so clearly.
Yeah. Well, we have these experiences, you and I, in the scientific world, be it social science or physical science, and decades of seeing, hey, some people come around. Other people are dug into a mistaken position. Well, they're going to die. And so you're really not, while you may be debating them, it's really for third parties to get it, right? You want to do your best job to show that your opponent's position is incorrect and yours is right. And younger people often are more elastic and they'll adopt your point of view. So you're looking at the next generation. Now, unfortunately, we have to be looking at 9/11 to some extent that way, that it's getting the history right. And ultimately, you know, hey, it may turn our way. We never know. You know, something may break our way one day, and we could actually pursue justice. But if not, and that's the more likely, we got to get the truth right.
Morgan, let me invite you to give a summing up of what you believe Gerard contributed to 9/11 research as a way of concluding our conversation.
Well, I would say that Gerard's work on No Planes is certainly right up there with the Web Theory. And these pioneers, I would put in my top three researchers, along with Dr. Judy Wood. And by the way, Gerard didn't have much use for Dr. Judy Wood. takes us back to the kind of the crazy disunity out there. But I'm okay with it. But the point is, Girard's work is extremely powerful and I believe durable. And even though Girard ultimately dissed the Web Fairy, the Web Fairy's got Girard's work up on her website, so great credit to her for that. And here again, concentrate on the long run, and you can see how much good Girard's work, how good it was, and all the good it has done and will do. In fact, I was thinking about this, Jim. It would be great if we could put all these articles together, maybe a little light editing. We might have to make a few decisions, but it would be great to have that as a book.
Terrific idea, Morgan. Let you and I explore this. I want to thank you for coming on the show for the very first part of our memorial to Girard Holmgren. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, expressing appreciation of my special guest this first segment, Morgan Reynolds. Morgan, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for putting this together, Jim.
Take care, my friend.
Buys a ticket for a magical mystery tour. He knows what to expect. We guarantee him the trip of a lifetime, and that's just what he gets. The incredible magical mystery tour.
Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it? Who did it? The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Well, the night when
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, for the second segment of our discussion of Gerard Holmgren. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Rosalie Grable, also known as the Web Fairy, who is noted and admired for her contributions to No Planes Theory, to which Gerard himself contributed so much. Rosalie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Please do tell us a bit about your views of Gerard before we discuss some of the arguments he presented.
Well, he was the most influential person on my life, of my entire life. I got to spend a wonderful week with him when he came to America because his band won the best blues band in Australia contest, which was held in Memphis, and they didn't win. But after that, he had a month to spend, well, 3 weeks at that point, in the United States. He first came to Chicago, and we went quite, well, he wanted to meet up with some relatives of his family was spread all over the globe. One entire branch of his family was lost in the Holocaust. But another branch had come to America and settled near Chicago. So we went to a restaurant to meet them, and while we were getting ready for this, I looked on the internet and found a blues bar called Bill's Blues that was having a jam session that very night. So he brought his guitar along, and after the little family, we went to the blues bar, and I got some clips just on his little camera. You know, this was 2005 before we had fancy video cameras and all. But I do have a little clip of him doing the blues, Bill's Blues at 911closeup.com/blues-htm. He was an extremely accomplished and sophisticated blues guitarist, especially under living in Australia.
As you no doubt are aware, he and I butted heads in the beginning because after I founded Scholars and invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair, he was going after Steve, and I wound up writing several lengthy posts defending Steve and rebutting Holmgren. And as I mentioned to Morgan during the first segment, I'm not sure whether today, if I had known more, I would have been quite so defensive of Steve.
Well, I certainly hope not. We have a world where there's now the Gulf is going to fill up with oil. They're now talking about they may not be able to cap it at all. And we'll have Valdez incident amount of oil spewing out every 3 days for the next 10 years, which will, of course, make most of America uninhabitable.
It'll make the whole earth uninhabitable, Rosalie, because, you know, the food chain begins in the ocean and the microscopic organisms and the slightly larger prey on the smaller. And once you interrupt the food chain, all species at higher levels of evolution are destined for extinction. So this is
truly, we are on our strong path to extinction. But the point that I wanted to make is that before Steve Jones was noted as a plane hugger, he had almost single-handedly replaced the cold fusion of Pons and Fleischmann with his cold fusion reaction that was 100 powerful as the Pons-Fleischmann reaction, and then convinced the academic community that they should not fund any cold fusion research, partly in protection of the hot fusion and partly in protection of the fact that it would have made oil obsolete by now. This was in the early 80s. We would have cars run by a battery-sized device that would recharge itself forever by the dancing of the electrons inside. It's really sad.
What you're describing, Rosalie, has the character of an academic bait and switch. I mean, where, you know, Pons and Fleischmann have this very attractive theory about about cold fusion, and then in essence, Jones effects a substitution of a far inferior version.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. But since hot fusion gets billions of dollars of research dollars and has all the military implications, that gets the money, and cold fusion research was completely shut out. In fact, Hans and Fleischmann were not even physicists, they were chemists, because it's a chemical reaction that created this. But anyway, Jared Holmgren was on Steve Jones' case from the beginning. I do wish that you had read Jared Holmgren's work, which can be found still at thewebtheory.com/Holmgren/Holmgren.
Holmgren/Holmgren?
Yes, that's his general site that I kept from him. He didn't want me to have it after our terrible blow-up when he decided that he didn't want to say or do anything that might keep America from its destruction.
Fascinating, fascinating. What was your falling out over?
It was largely about the direction of the research and my support for Judy Wood, and more things that unless I'm really pushed, I'd rather not talk about at this moment.
But Holmgren was not a fan of Judy Wood, I take it. Morgan said as much, too.
No, he didn't like the fact that when when Professor Williams was presenting my work at the National Press Club, it was right along with Judy Wood and her unproven to him theories on the use of unconventional weaponry. I was thrilled because I've known all along, because of my research into the pages from the Book of Life, that there is an entire force that's not being used. But because of this fight and all, Jared Holmgren is one of the few people on this earth who could understand the missing parts because of his intense study into music and sound structure, the force that allows free energy. It uses the same dynamics and a pattern as music does, so the use of fifths and thirds and harmony would be vital in understanding the suppressed force.
You're talking about energy related to oscillations and vibrations.
Right. The kind of energy that can turn buildings into dust while we're standing.
Rosalie, turning to your first encounters with Gerard, when did you first realize he was out there and that you might have something to learn from him?
He was extremely influential in the original 9/11 movement, long before the fact there were no planes was even thought of. And he was in Australia on his 386 machine that couldn't even see pictures. So until he could see the pictures for himself, he had, of course, no interest in my conjecture that there was no planes involved. But once he did have a computer that could see pictures, he looked and said, oh, my God. And then it was just a question of how to break it to the world, because he was widely and universally respected for his physical and mathematical
talents, ability.
It brought the fact that there was no plane at the Pentagon from a fringe conspiracy theory into factual evidence that has still never been refuted. The best they could do is simply ignore it.
Well, tell me what you consider to be some of his most important arguments, Rosalie.
You'll find this at 911closeup.com on the front page. His most compelling arguments for the fact there were no planes is on the front page there.
Why don't we talk about that, Rosalie? That seems to me very important, why, you know, that the world should understand why it may have made more sense to have no planes than to have planes. I mean, that seems so counterintuitive initially, and yet once you understand it, it makes such great sense.
Right? Sometimes people ask me, why would they use missiles or whatever and run the risk of being caught out? If they're going to tell a story about planes, why not make it as convincing as possible and use real planes? It's a silly question because in the face of direct visual and forensic proof that they didn't use planes, mostly supported by what little witness evidence we have, speculations about them thinking and planning are meaningless. Nevertheless, since we live in extremely silly times, I'm going to address this question on its own terms. Put yourself in the position of the purse. You have to think about what could go wrong in each possible scenario and then decide which scenario poses the smallest risk. You want to tell a story about hijacked planes. At the first level of decision-making, you have two choices. One, use actual planes. Two, use missiles or whatever the blob's loving thing is and convince people that they were planes. Let's look at the second scenario. If the media on your side to tell the story, what could go wrong? One, people might see they're not planes and report it. Well, this actually happened, but it seems that nobody takes any notice. The myth of thousands of witnesses to a big plane strike keeps getting trotted out on the basis of a circular assumption. Because big jets were there, people must have seen them. Because people saw them, that proves they were there. Clearly, the perps thought about how to minimize the problem of contrary witness reports and came up with a simple but effective plan. This problem is easy to minimize. The first strike happens, and because the object is small and fast and unexpected, no one is too sure what it is or whether they thought correctly. A few witness reports go to the air, reporting missiles or small planes or no craft at all, but there's only an 18-minute window for this to occur before the whole world sees a big jet light on TV using commercially available real-time animation technology. This distracts the media from interviewing many witnesses to the second strike because everyone is just fixated on the video replay. Those few witnesses who might get a moment in the media, they lack confidence in what they saw because, once again, the object was small, fast, and unexpected. Seeing the TV replay, which was instantly available, would make most people think they just didn't see it properly. The few who remain unshakable in their belief it was not a large thing are easily shouted down and drowned out by the endless replays. In addition, the airlines release a statement saying they've lost two big jets and any witness dissident is instantly, the moment the strike happens, marginalized almost to the point of oblivion. This is not speculation. Read through the transcripts of broadcasts as they unfolded between about 8:47 and 9:30, and you will see this is exactly what happened. From the moment the second strike occurred, anyone who tried to say it was not a large jet immediately had a TV replay shoved in their face. What little witness evidence was gathered in the brief time available between the two strikes was not enough to do any real damage, and afterward everyone was corrupted by having TV replays of the second jet shoved in their face as soon as they opened their mouth. In that brief period between the two strikes, there was only one witness who said large jet, and that just happened to be the vice president of CNN, which is, of course, major player in the scam, just as pivotal as the government. So we can see that the problem of contrary witnesses, while a minor inconvenience, is easily overcome with some good planning. Again, this is not speculation. The successful execution of this plan has been tested in the real world as it works. The scenario I have outlined is exactly what the documented record of the event. Once the sheeple factor set in, everyone is chanting, what about the people who saw it, without ever bothering to check with those people that actually did report? And if they do check, the number of reports are not high enough to inflict major damage on the official story. Well, there is overwhelmingly support something other than a big jet. but there wasn't enough evidence, enough trying to gather enough numbers for this to be a significant factor. And so the ordinary person on the street, most of them would have been easily convinced that they just didn't see it properly. Some might have lingering doubts or suspicions, but would easily be silenced by ridicule and denial from the overwhelming pressure of the TV footage and the whole world trying to convince themselves they just didn't see it properly. Most would eventually come to believe that themselves. So that problem is easily dealt with. No cover story solves everything, and doubtless there are still some mutterings of doubt and suspicion among some people who are there, but it isn't enough to cause a serious problem. None of the other problems. Someone might look at the videos and see what's really there, which is exactly what Rosalie has done. And people go to the mind control denial. The alternative media is flooded with endless debunkers. The perps knew our collective psychology well. They certainly wouldn't be happy with the groundswell of awareness which Rosalie has kick-started, but it looks very manageable compared to the problem I'm about to outline with the strategy of using real jets. Again, this is not speculation. The way that both of these problems have been handled has been tested in the real world. It fits exactly with the documented record. And the fact that I am even needing to write this 3 years after Rosalie first busted the video evidence is testimony to how wisely the perps judge their choice and strategy. Now let's look at the other choice, using real jets. This immediately splits into two sub-choices, pilot them with suicide pilots or remote control them. The problem with the first choice is obvious. I think most people on this list have already accepted the absurdity and monstrous difficulties of such a scenario, so I won't go there. Remote control. Before addressing problems with that, the scenario splits into more sub-choices. Hijack a real flight with real passengers aboard. 2, launch a plane from somewhere else and pass it as a real flight. Basically, the choices here split into the option of crashing a plane with passengers aboard or no passengers aboard. Both possibilities create potentially insurmountable problems with the cover-up and a reduced likelihood of the crash being successfully targeted to begin with. Let's look at the latter problem. While it's certainly feasible to remote control a large jet into towers, it's a high-precision targeting job for an aircraft with very limited maneuverability. The significant risk that the plane won't hit its target properly, that it will hit some other building, just put its wing on the tower and crash into the street or cause a cascade of damage on the other non-targeted buildings, miss altogether and finish up in the Hudson, still reasonably intact, all kinds of risks. Whatever the calculated likelihood of a successfully targeted crash would have to be significantly lower than that of a missile blob thing, which is specifically engineered for such precision strikes. Even the smallest increase in the risk of the target not being hit properly would be completely unacceptable given the easily manageable nature of any problems associated with the alternative scenario. And missing the target is only the beginning of the problem. What about the aftermath? Once it misses the target, there's a significant risk that the aircraft might crash in such a manner that it's reasonably intact. Rescue workers and emergency services who are completely innocent of the scam and ordinary people wanting to help out reach the wreckage before any pursers, given that where it crashed couldn't be foreseen. And what are they going to find? 2 choices. A plane with no one in it. How are the perps going to explain that, huh? Well, a plane with passengers, this raises even more problems. Using a plane with passengers creates 2 more sub-choices. Hope that all the passengers get killed in the crash so there's no survivors to talk, or hope that the perps can get killed first and knock them off before they do talk. Kill them with the crash of a timed release of gas into the aircon system, which of course leaves more forensic evidence to cover up. And it goes on from here, but you can see from this clip the logical structure of Holmgren's mind and of his arguments and of the choices that he makes.
Yeah, I think it's extremely interesting, Rosalie, that he thought through so clearly the disadvantages of using real planes and the advantages of faking it. That's very interesting. I highly recommend this piece, which is at 911closeup.com/.
Yeah.
Very nice piece, Rosalie. He did have a very systematic mind. I admire that.
Yeah. Let me find a mathematical article about the Pentagon, which was even more incredibly overwhelming.
Yeah, tell us about his views on all four of the crashes. We've talked a bit about the Twin Towers. What were his views about the Pentagon and Shanksville?
He didn't think much about Shanksville. The Pentagon, however, was out at the big web at woodperry.org, Holmgren, Intro HTML, The Physical and Mathematical Analysis of the Pentagon Crash by Jared Holmgren. There's 11 parts, an introduction, and a summary.
Why don't you begin with the summary?
All right, we'll go for summary. Summary, it is physically impossible for all of the plane to have entered the crash site. This is backed by solid mathematical proof. There's no evidence outside the building of wreckage to account for parts of the plane which cannot have entered the crash site. There's no evidence of identifiable wreckage inside the crash site. Cremation of a plane was unprecedented in aviation history and physically impossible. Even if such a cremation had been possible, it is impossible in the context of modest damage to the wall. The hole in the back of the third ring cannot be explained by any means other than a missile. Fake wreckage has been designed and planted with the express purpose of impersonating the American Airlines color scheme. Eyewitness evidence is inconclusive, and fabricated witness reports have been presented to try to shore up the official story. Claims the DNA testing identified 63 of the 60 people on board are mutually exclusive with the claims that the plane was cremated, with the official line on the WTC victims and the Valley bombing victims. Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about your own. You obviously affected Holmgren in his thinking. What stage was your thinking at when Holmgren first encountered your work?
Well, I had my original site, which is now in sell up at thewebferry.com/what's-it. And all I knew was that there was no plane in the first hit footage. And my entire claim to fame.
No plane in the not day footage.
There's no plane there.
Yeah.
There just ain't.
Right. There's the flying what's it or the flying pig or whatever. I love your time sequence image.
Yeah, I've done the best I could. I've spent a long time trying to make it look better. But my 10-year-old nephew got me locked up in a mental hospital for my no plane delusions.
Really? Really?
While I was locked up, this was back in 2003, by wonderful coincidence, comma, whatever, that's when Jared Holmgren discovered that the Flights 11, which is the first hit, and 77, that's the Pentagon hit, were completely missing from the BTS database, which is just a bean counter database kept up to make statistics on time flights. But these two planes did show from that, using a completely separate stream of evidence, had never taken off that day. And not only hadn't taken off, but the planes themselves, because they were regularly scheduled airline flights, they had to have been canceled at least 10 days in advance to not appear in the database at all. Now, the BTS database was also used in the databases of companies that booked flights. If it was a flight in the BTS database, then that was a flight you could buy tickets on. So that's one way that we know that there were no innocent citizens buying innocent citizen tickets on these two particular flights, because they weren't in the database of the BTS, and therefore wouldn't be in the database of any of the ticket sellers.
Substantiating the claim, of course, that they were phantom flights that were manufactured for the purpose of propaganda in creating the 9/11 mythology.
Right. Yeah.
Rosalie, Rosalie, I can't thank you enough for coming on to participate in this memorial to Gerald Holmgren. I look forward to having you back on the show again, and thank you for being here today.
I had so much more to say about his life and what he was like as a human.
Rosalie, we'll do. We'll do more about it. Thank you so much. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Rosalie Grable. We'll be right back.
Stem cell research. Abortion. Cloning. Evolution. Creation science. Intelligent design. These are hot-button issues today. Religion and science. Morality and government. Corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Rosalie Grable, the web fairy, about Gerard Holmgren, where Rosalie had a very extensive interaction with Gerard. Rosalie, I'm glad to have you back for this third segment of our conversation about Gerard Holmgren.
Great. Yeah, I have hundreds, thousands even, of unpublished emails from him, and I think that the world gets to see someday, but I think that he's getting his wish come true, and America as we knew it will soon be ready for the smoke he's getting pitchforked, which he was really into by the end when he took his work down, because he didn't think that especially Americans were worthy of knowing anything that was actually happening. And he didn't want to say or do anything that might accidentally save even one of us.
I'm on the website, thewebfairy.com/Holmgren/Holmgren, and here I have, you know, you have a collection of Holmgren's research and writing on 9/11, and there's a key piece here. Actually, a copy of his website. So the title of this is Manufactured Terrorism, The Truth About September 11th, first published April 18th, 2004. Rosalie, that's astounding. He'd already by 2004.
After he had a computer that was capable of creating a website when he first started, and was a very well known in whatever little bitty 9/11 movement that there was, Jared Holmgren was one of his most influential people. And after he started corresponding with me, who had absolutely no credibility left at all, and had taken, you know, every attack from every direction for 10 minutes after I discovered there were no things there, we had an excellent communication. And it was after he discovered that was missing, that 77 and 11 were completely missing from the database. The BTS, that was his first original amazing piece of work.
Has the government ever responded to the missing data there about 11 and 77?
Sure. After he came out with that, the BTS database vanished. And then when it came back, there were indeed entries for 11 and 77, but they weren't taking off.
They weren't for taking off?
They had no runway to take off from. So then we noticed that, and the disappears again. And when it reappears, the planes are now taking off, but they're taking off from helipads. And as far as I know, in the BTS database, the planes are still taking off from helipads. But since, you know, nobody is paying that much attention to the exact what that exact number of an exact runway means to anybody, they got away with it.
So we never did have
old news.
Old news, yeah. But new still to some, you know. I mean, the whole business with the planes is all so mysterious to most Americans and even our audience.
As far as I know, Holmgren may have made a will to get down all of his stuff. And now that I have his work up again, now that he is, and I will put it in quotes with a tear in my eye, safely dead, he can no longer nail bomb me for moving himself up. Not that it'll save anybody, because now that the Gulf is turning into a sea of oil, we're doomed anyway. So now there's no problem that Jared has to worry that anybody might get saved by reading something that he wrote.
Oh my. How bittersweet.
I want to tell you about Jared Holmgren, and he lived outside of Sydney, Australia, along the Parramatta, I mean, you pronounce it wrong, Parramatta River. It's a suburb of Sydney, which, you know, is all separated out. It lived in what was a really, really rich area on a piece of property that somebody else had paid more than $1 million for. It was had a little bitty house that would be considered a teardown, and an overgrown yard that had been abandoned because, you know, they were just waiting to turn it into another Ritzy condo or something. But it just happened to have been built over a shallow part of the Sydney sewer system. So nobody could ever tear down that little house and put up some old big condo or something again. It must have been quite incongruous in its neighborhood. after Holmgren had his nephew Oliver did wonders with the yards and all, and he was having a green thumb on his family. His brother is David Holmgren, the guy who behind the permaculture movement.
So it's quite a brilliant and talented family.
So yeah, on his mother's side, he is Jewish, and his mother, they lived up near Perth, I think, or they had to get their meat from Perth. It was a long way, but because they were Jewish and very Orthodox, his grandmother's family went without heat. There was a big hole in their potbelly stove that they couldn't afford to fix because they had to send clear to Perth for their meat. And his mother thought that was so stupid that when she grew up, she didn't want to marry anybody who was Jewish. And so she found a Swedish guy named Holmgren, and that's how Jared Holmgren became Jared Holmgren.
Interesting.
But on his mother's side lost an entire branch of their family to the Holocaust. They were trying fanatically and frantically to get them to Australia, but the prejudice of the day and the law that can happen, so they all died. So the Holocaust was very important to Jerry because built into him. His family was socialist, and he grew up and did political meetings and all, but didn't come out, you know, particularly political himself. He was more this incredible logic focus. But of course, when you have this incredible logic focus, if you get a wrong premise in there, it can do great havoc. And once not everything that Jared believed was true, once he became enmeshed in various paranoias, because he wasn't the most patient person in the world, but, you know, everybody has flaws, and I guess.
When did this set in, Rosalie?
Fighting off you guys was the first notice. I mean, at least in my imagination, when the great Jim Fetzer appeared, it was at least my imagination that because he knew so much about the Kennedy thing being bad, he'd pick up and he'd be our ally. And lo and behold, you know, all these years later, you figured it out. But
Rosalie, I know. I can't believe that I wasn't really open-minded about no planes and all that and didn't appreciate Holmgren's work because, you know, I had just founded Scholars and invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair, and the next thing I knew, Holmgren was attacking Jones mercilessly, and I rose to his defense, and, you know, that may have been a huge blunder on my part, but there it was.
All we can do is deal with the life we've got left. I mean, we've all made mistakes in our lives, and I've made mine, and we can't undo what we can't undo.
So I must have been a source of great frustration to Holmgren because I was defending Jones.
Yeah. Because when we thought suddenly, finally, somebody was going to come and notice, because you had all the background that it would take from your prior experience with the Kennedy thing.
Yes.
So that we really didn't have any alternative other than to imagine that you were a spook.
To imagine I was a spook.
It must be. to be holding up for Steve Jones, who didn't even know what kind of plane he was claiming hit the building, but he knew it was a plane, and we should just trust him on that.
I should have got out of the way, Rosalie.
Yeah. Like I say, we've got our regrets, and we're allowed to have our regrets, and our regrets become part of us.
Well, I was telling Morgan how it took him about a year and a half of clubbing me over the head to become open-minded and start featuring guests, you know, on the show about these things. And then, of course, I became educated after a long lapse and began to see how impossible it was that these videos could be authentic.
Yeah, well, Morgan has a large and unpublished exchange with Jared Holmgren, which should be published. It should be a real book. It should be available at Amazon.com. And, you know, Morgan has enough name to pull that off. It's a wonderful one. He wouldn't even have to edit it. But, Jared Holmgren took Morgan Reynolds in hand and explained all of this and re-explained and re-re-explained. And then by now, you know, in that retrospect, we know it was community pressure, which there is. Community pressure does change the way we see and perceive things. It just does. And Morgan was trying to backtrack, but one of them, you know, it was a perfect storm. That's all I can say. It was a perfect storm. Holmgren himself, he was no favor to himself, always being so adversarial. And, I wish I could think of a way that we could have approached the problem of Steve Jones on a collegial level back then, instead of having to fight it out. But on the other hand, you know, one of the people who turned Holmgren against me was the 9/11 eyewitness guy who, it turned out, slowed down his footage to make it fake in its own way. So that told me he's an eyewitness. I mean, you can't slow down footage and then present it as authentic in the same breath.
Yeah.
There's no way back now because Jared Holmgren says he's dead.
Gerald
picked a good time to get off, and I always told him I wanted to be off stage and watch these suckers as they reach their vastly deserved fate. But it looks kind of done stuck among the Smokies too, and when the time comes, he can pitch for me. Yeah.
Even though he praised you early on and felt that you had been the one who cracked this nut of no planes, he later...
He loved me, and he felt betrayed by me.
And he was betrayed by you because you looked at 9/11 eyewitness footage, which had been slowed down by its producer.
No. I noticed that later. And he felt betrayed by me because he wanted to just back off from all of this stuff. He figured that everybody was corrupt, and I can see his point now, but that we should just go away, and it looked to me like we were so close. But he was right, and I was following a chimera. I wanted to keep going with Nico's TV fakery research, because if they couldn't understand no planes, maybe once they understood the TV fakery part, then they could start comprehending there were no planes. But then instead they turned it into everything's fake, and then calling all of my first hit evidence fake. So Holmgren got the last laugh on that one, too.
Well, it was separating TV fakery from no planes that got me open-minded about it, because I was familiar with video fakery or film fakery from JFK, and that gave me access, you know, to looking at whether the films could be authentic. And, of course, I became convinced by several lines of argument, probably most importantly, the impossible speed, that the plane was flying too fast to be aerodynamically possible, that melting into the building as it did meant the building provided no more resistance to the plane's trajectory than air, and of course, counting the number of frames and discovering that, you know, instead of, you know,
yeah.
It really was
well,
lying.
You had so much invested in the opposition for you to do the 180 and notice, oops, they were right. And, it's just so sad that Holmgren had already, you know, I remember when I got an email from you and Morgan saying, can we still get Holmgren to come to your thing? And I could write back because he's not speaking to me either.
Oh, trying to get Holmgren to Madison?
If he had spoken at your thing in 2005.
Seven.
That would have been a whole different world than the one we've got.
Did Holmgren understand that I'd come around, that I realized that I'd finally become open-minded about it and realize they were right?
I had no clue. Told me he didn't want to speak to me, I never tried. And I'm feeling bad about that.
So,
finally, I had to block him entirely to keep from being nail-bombed. And then the emotional left to know, and it gets me very sad and down.
And of course, when you talk about, you read through his piece about why they didn't use real planes. I mean, it should have crumpled outside the building, the wings broken off the tail, the body seats, luggage fallen to the ground. It would have been a hell of a mess.
Yeah, but we figure that people didn't really read what he wrote. And they just a two-paragraph summation by somebody else.
Yeah, I found that true in relation to my own work. Most people just trade in rumors or impressions that they're conveyed by somebody else.
The actual work, you get some fancy about it. It's like on the front page of the Post today, they have, there's this peaceful fellow.
Yes.
Israel had an attack from a helicopter.
Yes.
But the thing in the Post says that it was the flotilla people who had stun grenades.
How insane can you get?
Like these people who are fighting with sticks and knives and still having a couple of them, were using the sophisticated Israeli weapons on Israelis.
How ridiculous can you get?
Yeah.
And Rosalie, I've seen this early footage, where they claim it's the passenger is using these metal bars to beat up the commandos. But all the ones who are swinging these metal bars seem to be physically very fit. They all seem to be about the same size and physical agility of the commandos. They seem to be dressed a little differently, but the way they're swinging those bars, they're experienced in doing this. And I have no doubt that they were actually clubbing, passengers aboard the ship.
Oh boy, that's interesting.
It's just fraud. It's just fraudulent all the way around.
Yeah, but then, we've got all of this important evidence that is their video taken from their helicopter, and
yes,
they were doing their thing, and people could call it fake just because it appears in the wrong paper, and it doesn't suit their political.
As though armed commandos.
There's no reason to call anything fake beyond you think it's fake, and the mere act of thought is what makes it fake instead of any physical reality or objective reality that the footage began. And my friend Peg, she put up with so much with this John Galt creature calling shadows fake just because they were too sharp to look like what he imagined a shadow would look like. It was horrible how long they managed to get this. What I suffered through to prove that the first hit footage and the endless entrance footage are both absolutely authentic. The first hit footage has been, cheesed with, but what exists of it is actually existing existence. The only thing added in is a little roof of plane wing before there is one on the building after the explosion.
So what we have are two different situations. In the first hit, we have authentic footage of a fake non-existent plane. In the second, we have fake footage of a
it's just another decay, just another layer of the convolution of it, and then taking advantage of the fact that people's ability to see things is so completely judged out by what they believe. It's like, I used to call it, they see with their bellies.
I think Americans are so... Rosalie, I think Americans are so used to seeing, you know, fakery every day on television and in the movies that they have lost their capacity to judge the difference between the real and the illusory.
Oh, obviously, and it's playing out again with this flotilla thing, with the, you know, when they get down to showing the real footage and then just re-saying what it means, and since they're saying it on the front page of all the papers, and even the mayor told us, has this all-encompassingness that overwhelms our objective senses, what little amount we have. But at least they're putting it right on the table now. They're showing us quite obviously how they re-figure reality to suit themselves.
You mean that it's so blatant in this case what they're trying to do to manipulate public opinion?
Yeah. Of course, I don't believe that Israel is Jewish either. So, you know, I know it's another layer of conspiracy.
Well, I'm hoping that Turkey will follow through on its assertion that it's going to send another ship accompanied by a Turkish vessel of war.
They want to start a war, and they don't care who fights it. But I say Israel hates Jews. Israel is not Jewish. It's run by a Jews college, quote-unquote, which is a part of the City of London complex, Red Needle Street, where even the Queen must bow. The Illuminati postage stamp, London, of the occult and conspiracy theorists.
Rosalie, in the few minutes that remain, could you give us a summary of Gerald Holmgren's lasting significance for 9/11 research?
Give me
a summary. Give me your take on Holmgren's contributions to 9/11 research.
He needs to be published. He needs for people to read this. He has bowed out, faked out, and quit, stabbed me in the back and left at the moment that we were finally breaking through. So, very few, especially once he started taking down himself, deserves to be rid anyway.
Was this
much beyond problems as humans? There's larger than we have comprehended yet that Gerald Holmgren explains quite plainly, and he deserves to be read any philosopher would be read, whoever's your favorite.
Well, Aristotle, Kant, and Peirce, but I would say he deserves to be read as much as David Ray Griffin.
He deserves to be read as much as Karl Marx.
And you have a website here then, the webfairy.com/Holmgren/Holmgren, where you can find Gerald Holmgren's own...
webfairy.com/Holmgren.
Thewebfairy.com/Holmgren/Holmgren/, yes.
And then there's... 911closeup.com.
Right, which you read before.
911closeup.com/blues, HTML, to watch Holmgren in action on the stage at Bill's Blues in Chicago, Illinois.
Terrific, yeah. Rosalie. Very nice, very nice. I want to thank you for being here for the third segment of our discussion about Gerald Holmgren. I think you've made a lot of very illuminating points. Thank you so very much.
And thanks to Peggy for giving me a piece of her time on this.
And this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing our memorial to Gerald Holmgren. We'll be right back.
Stop, she's a go-getter.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Glaubt sie liebt nur mich, gestern hab ich sie gesehen. Sie denkt ja nur an dich und du solltest zu ihr gehen. Oh ja, sie liebt dich, schöner kann es gar nicht sein. Ja, sie liebt dich und da solltest du dich freuen. Du hast ihr wehgetan. Sie wusste nicht warum, du warst nicht schuld daran und drehtest dich nicht um. Oh ja, sie liebt dich, schöner kann es gar nicht sein. Ja, sie liebt dich und da solltest du dich freuen. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein. Du musst jetzt zu ihr gehen, entschuldig dich bei ihr. Ja, das wird sie verstehen und dann verzeiht sie dir. Oh ja, sie liebt dich, schöner kann es gar nicht sein. Ja, sie liebt dich und da solltest du dich freuen. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein. Denn mit dir allein kann sie nur glücklich sein.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing the memorial in honor of Gerard Holmgren. My guest this segment is Nico Haupt. Nico, you've had various relations with various parties involved here. Give us your take on what Gerard contributed and how it affected 9/11 research.
I have to start from the scratch, of course. First of all, thanks whenever the segment will take place. It was a hard decision. Also, I understand not everyone liked the idea that I speak in your show, and I also considered not to do it because holding myself no one to talk on your show. Anyway, I met Gerard Holmgren, as far as I recall, at the end of 2001. Very close to the Democratic Underground Quorum, a related mailing list or undemocratic underground.com itself. This was and still is an existing formulated Democratic Party. Also a little bit neocon infiltrated at the time, but we were all naive these days. But both we had in common is we never were really interested in political activism or political, let's say, bullshit arguments. I read the first thing from Holmgren as referring to the research of Gerald Israel, and I found his analysis very sharp. He had the same cynical soundbite that I used to have, which was not as strong as people know me for much later. But I came more or less from music and entertainment. He came, I think, just from sound theory, blues music, and logical argument. It took a while to really get along, but I had a feeling I need him also in my first established group linked to most scientific people where I wanted to establish scientific evidence on 9/11. And he had also showed interest in this. I didn't much care about his background. I had two other three suspicions of people, whether too intelligent, might have been linked to Mossad or German intelligence, or that we all get gamed against each other, and it's a big mind experiment how we deal with different ups and downs. But we had a very dry but good relationship in the beginning. I think what stuck most out was when he found the Bureau of Transportation database, which logically proved that the flight itself linked to the official first flight crashing into officially crashing Twin Towers did not exist. Maybe it was flight 11. It was not listed in that week. And as far as I know the details, it was not listed for 1 week. He did the same flight 77, which did not exist at all. We did screenshots that time already, and that alone, combined with scientific evidence, proved that there were no flights linked to 9/11, and of course also scientific evidence, which didn't make us the no-planers yet, because that insult word did not exist at that time. That was very, very early. I think his biggest contribution was definitely this research, but also his masterful written articles, very straight, very Hegelian. 9andcloseup.com compiled most of them. I think in the top five of all-time contributions is definitely on number three, then his consistencies of hunting down what we already call his comedian language, the spooks and perps or half-perps or truthlings. I learned from him basically the basics of how to build up a logical argument and maybe even winning it. So at that time, I was a little bit the kiddie surrounded by Rosalie Grable as a mother complex figure, or maybe a little bit grandmother also, and Holmgren was a father complex figure. Top five, definitely his transgression. I respect him just for that, that he always stayed to his own idealism, and it didn't change basically his main line of just logical transparency of logical argument and evidence. So that's just logical for me also that he had to turn against all of us, whether it was based on the one or other reason. But I learned basically also my transgression from him. I cannot condemn this.
Nico, I think that, you know, under other circumstances that Holmgren and I would have got along very well because, you know, I spent 35 years teaching logic and critical thinking and scientific reasoning. But when he, you know, when I founded Scholars in December 2005 and invited Steve Jones to be my co-chair at the suggestion of David Ray Griffin, Holmgren immediately began attacking Jones, and I, not having perhaps sufficient background to appreciate what was going on, spent quite a bit of time dealing with Holmgren and defending Jones. I have mixed feelings about that at this point in time, but that's where I was in terms of my state of understanding. Was that very frustrating to Holmgren and others?
Well, he basically made research on all so-called newbies, including on yourself. I was also the main research on this, we immediately found Durling's and Steve Jones' background. So that was, for us, completely politically incorrect to have him associated with you. So basically, in a diagonal, who's the worst of the worst, we could not deal with the fact that Jones would be included in this. So it makes complete sense, and I was completely on the same page with Holman, that we both didn't want to support you from the beginning as well.
Yes. Well, I understand that now in retrospect. Also, of course, you know, Morgan, it took Morgan over a year and a half to convince me that I should look at the evidence of possibly no planes, and it was only when I really separated video fakery from no planes that I got a handle on it and began to feature guests on the show. I must have had 15 different guests, looked at so many videos, and of course became convinced, as I am today, that the videos were fake, that the plane couldn't possibly have been traveling the speed, it couldn't have impacted with the building, that it was passing through its own length through air in the same amount of number of frames it was passing into the building through its own, should have crumpled, should have tails, should have broken off people, luggage, bodies fallen to the ground. I mean, I'm completely convinced today, but it sure took me a long time, and I guess that must have made me quite a target for those of you who understood better the video evidence.
Paul Holman was a strictly principalist. From his point of view, there was no chance to become supportive of your stuff at all. I also was on a similar but emotional background-based opinion. I was already much more into the public than Holman. What I always try to work out is that Holman himself should speak, because I think that language and text, as we tested the other day, has always a different impression on people. If the voice recording from the other side is just a little bit louder, it makes the actual guy to the moderator and more convincing. So I try to make the best out of it to convince Holman. Well, I hope to guarantee you that the sound quality at St. Mark's Church when I want him to speak will be as good as possible. You have to basically lay this into your speech that you could be manipulated over that in case sound quality will screw up. And we had a friend who was at that time no planner. No, help me out. No, I'm losing also some chronology names. He worked also at the MIT.
Jeff.
Yeah, try also to get more.
The guy in engineering, wasn't it Jeff? Well, back to us. Yeah.
Well, Jeff and me were both at the event from Jimmy Walters. I forgot. Basically, this was also went by a way where I met Peggy Carter. And so that should make people think how people getting maybe calculated or arranged against each other. I believe that 9/11 was planned at least 30 years ago in the 70s. It is possible that some intellectual, intelligent families were mapped constantly because of the artificial intelligence program. And this is the theory Holman never lied. It was way out of there. I said, no, I stand by my words. I will declare myself as a 9/11 plot thought. I think I got picked for one of the main researchers by just calculating me into New York. I'm more strong on this theory than ever before. I'm very suspicious. Honeypots in my life. I was twice beaten up now. Of course, I never kill because they're all controlled. And Holman, I consider to be my father complex figure. I said, no, they're playing us about the father-mother complex thing, and there will be one day when we will be angry about this. We debate for 1 year. How do we deal with anger management before any one of us freak out? We discuss this. Should we become angry? Should we do violence? And we said, no, we don't want to do it. So it's very funny, and I hope Lily has still these emails that we talk like little kids with each other. Gerald Holmgren, I think he was an authentic guy. Very angry, of course, very transgressive at the end. Maybe he got cancer or that. I personally will not rule out that he got cancer. I still try to fix my relations with him exactly 2 weeks prior to his death. I send them a very personal link from a very personal wiki where I start building up some infiltration guide. And, of course, he did not respond. But this is exactly 2 weeks leading into his cancer where he was diagnosed.
What kind of cancer?
He got the cancer based on broken heart or whatever, stress, or he got cancer. We will never prove this.
What kind of cancer did he have, Nico?
I think it was some kind of rare cancer, and it's somewhere included in this tribute site of Facebook.
Tell me, what was Gerard's overall view about 9/11? Why did 9/11 take place in his view?
I think he had no real political idea in general. We were speculating about a lot of stuff for years. And, of course, I was always way out with some ideas. I was always looking into the technology of the Internet itself, that we will have more strict realities itself. We never used the wording like in Alex Jones. It was not about New World Order or all these smoke screens. We were dealing with companies. We were somehow already eyeing very early that somehow Europe electronic defense companies did this with just some American companies as phony. And
how did Gerard think that the buildings, the Twin Towers, were destroyed?
He was very fair. He did not speculate at all. All he tried to lay out is that it couldn't have been conventional weapons.
Could not have been conventional weapons. I think we all agree about that,
he was very fair and not to speculate at all, but of course we all agree it must have been some kind of direct interweapon combination of all they have, Tesla. But in his article itself, he made sure he stayed to everything he could logically prove. And he was a master of it. He was a great talent, maybe in lifetime and history. Because what happens these days is a betrayal on human society in general. There are too many people in the majority getting fooled by smoke screens. And of course, this is my personal opinion, so I don't want to stress this out. But he was a great guy, and if he would have just followed his logical thinking, wouldn't have the mess we have right now.
I think that's possible. I certainly think he had an excellent intellect, and his reasoning was rigorous. Now, I have the impression from others that he was not happy with Judy Wood, however, although she obviously represents unconventional weaponry. Do you have an opinion? Are you aware of why he would have rejected her?
It was basically like behind the tables. I had already the idea that, okay, of course, Holmgren has to talk with Rep Ferry just by himself. I talk with Rep Ferry just by himself. I talk with Holmgren just by himself. So it's all these mixed combination. Now, again, I'm pointing out sometimes it's a friend-friend constellation, or it's a friend-mother-friend-father constellation. Yeah, psychology involved on this. And where the psychology the majority between in the sheep constellation, I think Holmgren and me didn't trust her from the beginning. So I tried to make it a little more general. I said it's highly plausible that her research is 80% solid, but her personality itself got planted against us to divert us. I was the first one pointed out, and I predicted it correctly right. I pointed out she's a multi-personality, and one of the personalities will appeal to Rosalie Grable's hero complex, is highly destabilized because she herself had to fight for her character online. So that's why I think Rosalie herself played first as hero icon Edna, which pissed off Holmgren completely. And when she then merged the Judy Wood isolation itself with Edna, of course, that pissed him off completely. And I said this is exactly the idea how insiders might have calculated. I'm calling it always calculated because planting means will be payrolled. Of course, he's not payrolled. So she was calculated in her life, appealing to our different emotional mindsets, and exactly this diversion, possibly calculated by perps, took place. Holmgren, me, and Rosalie got more and more separated, and over a couple of months and a year, and then when I was too much over-exploiting myself and used video as a, not necessarily an art form, but a music form, he didn't like this, and of course, like is underestimated. So we had this called the Night of the Long Knives 2, where everyone freaked out at the Rick Siegel Nylon Research Silicon Forum, which I carefully built up to school people. And of course, Holmgren didn't really like this kind of entertaining way. The Nylon Video Mashups, he was not so big a fan of it. Again, I defend also his take on that. We don't have necessarily to do all the same skills to promote or facts. So I respected completely that he did not want to join this Nylon Video Mashup scene. We have this transgression where maybe it's a very sophisticated additional operation or friendship that once and for dismantled. It started, most people don't know this, that actually his website was taken down while I was at that time, and totally uber-key. I immediately contacted Rory, said Holmgren's website is down. It might lead to some confusion or for some or emails got hacked, and all the whole day everyone became angry, and it was a masterpiece. If delegated by Spooks and Perps, most of the friendships and 80% of the no-players broke apart. So I believe it was a combination of emotional anger management trials from the outside, the family diversion script over years, the Judy Wood honeypot designed, and then some hacks at the end. So I had these 6-8 years, so I'm telling you, I was much more targeted in general. But I tried also to analyze where it's coming from. While Holmgren was not so much into these kind of speculations, though he believed also that technical hacks might occur and some psychological manipulation.
Where do you see the 9/11 movement standing today? How fragmented is it today? Does it have any potential?
It's basically nowhere. It's John Gold plus X. It's basically the good old John Gold following the line of the early shooters like Kyle Hens and Nick Levis. It's definitely, we are changed for Scientology, which means it has not so much to do with 9 truth anymore. And it's Alex Jones plus Rand Paul, which is Alex Jones knows that the 9 truth stuff doesn't sell anymore. 9 Interjob, of course, will be still promoted by Europeans, because the Europeans don't want to have my research to be popular, which says the Europeans in Ireland. That explains why so many scientists coming from Europe all of a sudden. For me, they're all perps. Harrod is clearly linked to a university, which is not even a serious college. It's sponsored by a pharmacy for years. They changed the law so that it could be privatized, sponsored by a pharmacy. I don't trust any of these nine scientists which talking on right now. The other front is manipulated by Bechtel people. So that they were just smoke screening around these C4 thermite issues for maybe a couple of more months until we have a complete brave new world. And nothing will be reversed anymore. I believe algo trading and high frequency trading is in these months highly organized. There's much more strange false facts around. And I don't want to talk about all these things now because that's not the issue. But Nylon Truth Movement is drying out, but it will be, as usual, the momentum will be built up to the anniversary.
So, do you think there's any potential there at all? Can it have a political influence or no?
No, in this sense, Holmgren died for a good cause then, because it's not longer anymore proof that Nylon was a falsehood. It is to destroy all kind of illogical paradigms. It is to think more logical again. Of course, I've had additional take on don't keep life too dry. Give a little entertainment. Use what Holmgren didn't like. Use comedy. Use a little bit of sex. He didn't like this. But between the Holmgren, the traditional Holmgren think, and whatever, XYZ, I just don't believe that we have enough people on this planet to turn things around. It might be just the 4-digit numbers. The majority is brainwashed and plugged in. There's no doubt about this.
Nico, let me ask you about Ground Zero. I take it that whatever plans there are for rebuilding are still really in very preliminary stages. Am I right, or is something going on there I'm unaware of?
Well, that's funny, actually. They started building one tower, which is, I think, it's a couple of floors already built. Of course, I still believe it's a scam.
You mean of the couple of floors are built of the so-called Freedom Tower?
Yeah, there's some additional towers. I think it's not the one or two, it's some four or five.
They got buildings.
Yeah, something. There's actually, I'm making more fun about the local scandal that they also want to build a mosque over there. Of course, there's a comedian saying, yes, I want to have Al-Qaeda on Ground Zero. So I want to have... I want to have a mosque on Ground Zero.
But surely, you don't think Al-Qaeda had anything to do with 9/11, surely?
No, of course, but as a comedian saying, I want to have Al-Qaeda on Ground Zero.
Uh-huh.
So if they're against the mosque, they should build a mosque.
For the sake of your act. Do you do
because of course, they have nothing to do with it, and Al-Qaeda does not exist at all. It's 99% Novalian smoke screen.
Do you performance comedy? Do you perform in any clubs?
I can also dismantle that. I can tell you what. The house where I live is spooker itself. I can highly dismantle that. I see it now as a big experiment, so I try to stay sane. But it's stand-up, which is not as good as when I'm just talking with other people. Of course, a lot of people are getting annoyed, but that thing is never recorded, as usual.
What's your? Do you have any involvement with anti-war activity?
No, not at all. I call them the biggest war criminals. I mean, they're so proud of the official 9/11 story. They have no clue about electronic space defense at all. No one talks about Thales Alenia Space, which is feeding Lockheed's ass again this week. Huge major contract on the Iridium satellite, which was originally built by Microsoft and the Nam Group and Motorola. And also ironically linked to the head of intelligence, which resigned last week, Dennis C. Blair. Head of Iridium, which was linked
to Lockheed. What was going on?
Now Iridium gets a contact to Thales Alenia Space. Lockheed gets another new one. They're building 72 new satellites, which is fair.
What was going on with Blair stepping down?
I don't know. It could be an inside joke. A little strange setback. Maybe the cold system inside, they're saying something new will happen among ourselves. If the head of US intelligence steps back, and the head of German... the German president steps back, which never happened in history at all. Then something strange going on. And, you know, I actually make a joke of it because it means I have no German president. Yeah. So since the translation of president in an analogy means Überhaupt, I'm making fun about this too. No matter what people think.
Well, Nico, I'm gonna have to have you back again sometime. Would it be right for me to say that in your view, if you looked at the 9/11 movement as a match, that Holmgren was the bright light of the match igniting, and that it flared up quite brilliantly and then extinguished, and now we have nothing but a piece of charcoal wood that remains?
Yeah, we have. I mean, the irony is that there's a big line of intellectuals that then it's ironically just Hung and you left and a few others who already stepped out a long time ago, including myself. So I'm not sure how long I'll participate in the whole context of 9/11. I'm saying that people don't realize that 9/11 was in Eurospace outside job linked to Thales Alenia Space, EJS, doesn't make the research, doesn't rethink history of the last 60 years, try to bring some logic into this, which means that it's possible that nuclear weapons never really worked or were over-accelerated to build slowly direct energy weapons. Then it all makes sense that they need 9/11 to finalize the new nuclear threat with direct energy weapons. So both left and right wings are false paradigms, and he was very good on this too, the false paradigms. People have to analyze what false paradigms are. And in the tradition of Holmgren and Gio Caras and others, and the bizarre or eccentric behaviorism of Nico Holt, something might be established, but I doubt it. I think Holmgren died at the right time. It's a new era which will come pretty soon. A lot of people will go insane over it because they will not distinguish all Marlboro's realities.
Nico,
I
want to
say I loved him. He was a good friend. I'm not sad that he hated me at the end too. I was hoping I could fix it one day, but there was no chance, and I believed in that truth movement. Then, in that way, it killed him.
Nico, I want to thank you for coming on the show, and I look forward to having you back. Thank you very much for participating in this memorial to Gerald Holmgren.
Yeah, see you with him. R.I.P.
Thanks so much.
Listener supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website with free MP3 archive links and interactive forums. Go to RevereRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation button.
This is Jim Fetzer on The Real Deal, continuing our memorial in honor of Gerard Holmgren. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Peggy Carter, who's going to read an extract from some of his work. Peggy?
Thank you for having me, Jim. Yes, Gerard Holmgren's work was extremely important in unraveling the hoax, the 9/11 false flag hoax that led to several wars and changing our legal structure. His work is important to preserve, and in that spirit, I would like to read a story that he wrote, which I believe elucidates the issues and convincing, compelling, and also very interesting from a logic standpoint, and does more to bring the false story, the hoax, to the surface than a very long paper by scientists such as Stephen Jones.
Peggy, please do read it.
Okay. Debunking conspiracy theorists. Astute observers of history are aware that for every notable event, there will usually be at least one, and often several, wild conspiracy theories which spring up around it. The CIA killed Hendrix. The Pope had John Lennon murdered. Hitler was half werewolf. Space aliens replaced Nixon with a clone. The bigger the event, the more ridiculous and more numerous are the fanciful rankings which circulate in relation to it. So it's hardly surprising that the events of September 11, 2001 have spawned their fair share of these ludicrous fairy tales. And as always, there is, sadly, a small but gullible percentage of the population eager to lap up these tall tales, regardless of facts or rational analysis. One of the wilder stories circulating about September 11th, and one that has attracted something of a cult following among conspiracy buffs, is that it was carried out by 19 fanatical Arab hijackers, masterminded by an evil genius named Osama bin Laden, with no apparent motivation than that they hate our freedom. Never a group of people to be bothered by facts. The perpetrators of this cartoon fantasy have constructed an elaborate woven web of delusions and unsubstantiated hearsay in order to promote this garbage across the internet and the media to to the extent that a number of otherwise rational people have actually fallen under its spell. Normally, I don't even bother debunking this kind of junk, but the effect that this paranoid myth is beginning to have requires a little rational analysis in order to consign it to the same rubbish bin as all such silly conspiracy theories. These crackpots even contend that the extremist Bush regime was caught unawares by the attack, had no hand in arm on them, and actually would have stopped them if they had been able. Blindly ignoring the stand down of U.S. Air Force, the insiders trading on airline stocks linked to the CIA, the complicit behavior of Bush on the morning of the attack, the controlled demolition of the World Trade Center, the firing of a missile into the Pentagon, and a host of other documented proof that the Bush regime was behind the attack, the conspiracy theorists seem doggedly to a silly story about 19 Arab hijackers somehow managing to commandeer 4 planes simultaneously and fly them around U.S. airspace for nearly 2 hours, crashing it into important buildings without the U.S. intelligence services having any idea it was coming, and without the Air Force knowing what to do. The huge difficulties with such a stupid story force them to invent even more preposterous stories to distract from its core silliness, and thus the tale has escalated into a mythic fantasy of truly gargantuan proportions. It's difficult to apply rational analysis to such unmitigated stupidity, but that is a task which I take on in this article. However, it should be noted that one of the curious characteristics of conspiracy theorists is that they effortlessly change their so-called evidence in response to each aspect which is debunked. As soon as one delusion is unmasked, they simply invent another to replace it and deny the first ever existed. Eventually, when they turn full circle through this endless and changing fantasy fog, they then reinvent the original delusion and deny that you ever debunked it, thus beginning the circle once more. This technique is known as the fruit loop, and it saves the conspiracy theorists from ever having to see any of their ideas through to their illogical conclusion. According to the practitioners in the fruit loop, 19 Arabs took over 4 planes by subduing the passengers and crew through the use of knives, guns, box cutters, and gas, and then used electronic guidance systems which they had smuggled on board to fly the planes to their targets. The suspension of disbelief required for this outrageous concoction is only for the hardcore conspiracy theorists. For a start, they conveniently skip over the awkward fact that there weren't any Arabs on the planes. If there were, one must speculate that they somehow got on board without being filmed by any of the security cameras and without being registered on the passenger list. But the curly question of how they are supposed to have got on board is all too mundane for the exciting world of the conspiracy theorists. With vague mumblings that they must have been using false IDs, never specifying which IDs they are alleged to have used or how these were traced to their real identity, they quickly bypass this problem to relate exciting and sinister tales about how some of the fictitious schemes were actually searched before boarding because they looked suspicious. However, as inevitably happens with any rebel's lives, this simply takes them into an even more difficult corner. How are they supposed to have gotten on board with all that stuff if they were searched? And if they used gas in a confined space, they would have been affected themselves, unless they also had masks in their luggage. Excuse me, sir, why do you have a box cutter, a gun, a container of gas, a gas mask, and an electronic guidance system unit in your luggage? A present for your grandmother? Oh, very well, sir, you get off. Very strange, says the security officer. That's the 4th Arabic man without an Arabic name who just got on board with a knife, gun, or box cutter, and gas mask. Why did that security camera keep flicking off every time one of these characters shows up? Must be one of those days, I guess. Asking any of these basic questions to a conspiracy theorist is likely to cause a sudden leap to the claim that we know that they were on board because they left a credit card trail for the tickets they've purchased and the cards they've rented. Since they used credit cards that identified them, how does that reconcile with the claim that they used false IDs to get on the plane? But by this time, the fruit loop is in full swing. As the conspiracy theorist tries to stay one jump ahead of this annoying and awkward rational analysis, it will allege that the hijackers' passports were found at the crash scene. So in the air they exult triumphantly, their fanatical faces lighting up with that deranged look of one who is just a revelation of questionable sanity. So they got on board with false IDs, but took their real passports with them. However, by this time, the Fruit Loop has been completely circumnavigated, and the conspiracy theorist exclaims impatiently, who said anything about false IDs? We know what seats they were sitting in. Their presence is well documented. And so the whole loop starts again. Well, why are they on a passenger list? You numbskull, they assume the identities of other passengers, and so on. Finally, out of sheer fascination with this circular method of creative delusion, the rational skeptic will allow them to get away with the scheme in order to move on to the next question and see what further delight awaits us in the unraveling of this marvelous, stupid story. How come their passport survived fiery crashes that completely incinerated the planes and all the passengers? The answer, of course, is just one of those strange coincidences. Those little quirks of fate that do happen from time to time, you know, like the same person winning the lottery 4 weeks in a row. The odds are astronomical, but, you know, these things do happen. This is another favorite deductive method of the conspiracy theorist. A probability drive in which they decide upon a conclusion without any evidence whatsoever to support it, and then continually speculate in a series of wildly improbable events and unbelievable coincidences to support it, shrugging off the impossibility of each event with the vague assertion that sometimes the impossible happens, just about all the time in the near world. There's a principle called Occam's Razor which suggests that in the absence of evidence to the contrary, the simplest explanation is most likely to be correct. Conspiracy theorists hate Occam's Razor. Having, for the sake of amusement, allowed them to get away with the silly story of the 19 invisible arrows, we move on to the question of how they are supposed to have taken over the plane. Hijacking a plane is not an easy thing to do. Hijacking it without the pilot being able to alert ground control is nearly impossible. The pilot has only to punch in a 4-digit code to alert ground control to a hijacking. Unconcerned with the awkward question of plausibility, the conspiracy buffs maintain that on September 11th, the invisible hijackers took over the plane by the rather crude method of threatening people with box cutters and knives and spraying gas after they had attached their masks, obviously, but somehow took control of the plane without the crew first getting a chance to punch in the hijacking code. Not just on one plane, but on all four. At this point in the tale, the conspiracy theorist is again forced to call upon the services of the improbability drive. So now that our incredibly lucky hijackers have taken control of the plane, all four pilots fly them with breathtaking skill and certainty to their fiery ends, all four pilots unflinching in their steely resolve for a swift meeting with Allah. Apart from their psychotic hatred of our freedom, it was their fanatical devotion to Islam which enabled them to summon up the iron will to do this, which is strange, because according to another piece of heresy peddled by the conspiracy buff, these guys actually went out drinking and womanizing the night before their great martyrdom, even leaving their Qurans in the bar. Really impeccable Islamic behavior. And then got up at 5 a.m. the next morning to pull off the greatest covert operation in history. This also requires us to believe that they were even clear-headed enough to learn how to fly a huge plane by reading flight manuals in Arabic in the car on the way to the airport. We know this because they supposedly left the flight manuals there for us to find. It gets better. Their practical training had allegedly been limited to Cessnas and flight simulators. But this is no barrier to the unflinching certainty with which they took over the planes and skillfully guided them to their doom. If they're supposed to have done their flight training with these tools, which would be available just about anywhere in the world, it's not clear why they would have decided to risk blowing their cover to U.S. intelligence services by doing the training in Florida, rather than somewhere in the Middle East. But such reasoning is foreign to the foggy world of the conspiracy theorists, too trapped in the constant rotation of the mental fruit loop to make their unsubstantiated fabrications seem even semi-believable. Having triumphantly established a circular delusion in support of the mythical eras, the conspiracy theorists now confront the difficult question of why there's nothing left of the plane. Anyone who has seen the endlessly replayed footage of the second plane going into the World Trade Center will realize that the plane is packed with explosives. Planes do not and cannot blow up into nothing in that manner when they crash. Did the mythical Arabs also haul a heap of explosives on board and manage to deploy them in such a manner that they went off in the exact instant of the crash, completely vaporizing the plane? This is a little difficult even for the conspiracy theorists, who at this point decide that it's easier to invent new laws of physics in order to keep the delusion rolling along. There wasn't explosives. It was an inside job. The plane blew up into nothing from its exploding fuel load. Remarkable! Sluggish combustible fuel, jet fuel, which is basically kerosene, which burns at a maximum temperature of around 800 C, had suddenly taken on the qualities of a ferociously explosive demolition agent, vaporizing 65 tons of aircraft into a puff of smoke. Never mind that the plane of that size contains around 15 tons of steel and titanium, which even the melting point are about double that of the maximum combustion temperature of kerosene, let alone the boiling point, which is what would be required to vaporize the plane. And then there's about 50 tons of aluminum to be accounted for, in excess of 15 pounds of metal for each gallon of kerosene. For the conspiracy theorists, such inconvenient facts are vaguely dismissed as mumbo-jumbo. This conveniently little phrase is their answer to just about anything factual or logical, like a conjurer pulling a rabbit out of a hat. They suddenly become fanatically insistent about the devastating explosive qualities of kerosene, something literal, completely unknown to science, but just discovered by them this very minute, blissfully ignoring the fact that never before or since in aviation history has a plane vaporized into nothing from an exploding fuel load. The conspiracy theorist relies upon Hollywood images, where the effects are always larger than life, and certainly larger than the intellect of these coins. It's a well-known fact that planes blow up into nothing on impact, they say, with pompous certainty. Watch any Bruce Willis movie. Care to provide any documented examples? If it's a well-known fact, then presumably this well-known fact brings some kind of documentation, other than Bruce Willis movies. At this point, the mad, cunning eyes of the conspiracy theorists will narrow as they sense the corner that they have backed themselves into. And plan their escape by means of another stunning backflip. The planes have never crashed into buildings before, so there's no way of telling, they encounter with a sly grin. Well, actually, planes have crashed into buildings before and since. Not vaporized into nothing. Oh, but not big planes with that much fuel, they shriek in a spherical denial. Or that much metal to vaporize. Yes, but not hijacked planes. Are you suggesting that whether the crash is deliberate or accidental affects the combustion qualities of the fuel? Now you're just being silly. Although collisions with buildings are rare, planes frequently crash into mountains, streets, other aircraft, nosedive into the ground, or have bombs planted aboard them, and don't vaporize into nothing. So what's so special about a tower? But by now, the conspiracy theorist has once again sailed happily around the food loop. It's a well-documented fact that planes explode into nothing on impact. Effortlessly weaving back and forth between position that is a well-known fact and that it's never happened before, so we have nothing to compare it to, the conspiracy theorists now convince themselves, if not treating other people, that the World Trade Center plane was not loaded with explosives and that the instant vaporization of the plane in a massive fireball was the same as any other plane crash you might care to mention. Round and round the fruit loop. But the hurdles which confront the conspiracy so many, and they are now forced to implement even more creative uses for the newly discovered, shockingly destructive qualities of kerosene. They have to explain how the Arabs also engineered the elegant vertical collapse of both the World Trade Center towers. And for this awkward fact, the easiest counter is to simply deny that it was a controlled demolition and claim that the buildings collapsed from fire caused by the burning kerosene. For this, it's necessary to sweep aside the second law of thermodynamics and propose kerosene, which is not only impossibly destructive, but also recycles itself for a second burning in violation of the law of degradation of energy. You see, it not only consumed itself in a catastrophic fireball, vaporizing a 65-ton plane into nothing, but then came back for a second go, burning at 2,000 feet for another hour at the impact point, melting the skyscraper's steel like butter, and while it was doing all this, it poured down the elevator shaft, starting fires through all the building. When I was at school, there was something called the entropy law, which suggests that a given portion of fuel can only burn once, something which is readily observable in the real world, even for those who didn't make it to junior high school science. But this is no problem for the conspiracy theorists. Gleefully, they claim that a few thousand gallons of kerosene is enough to completely vaporize a 65-ton aircraft, have enough left over to burn ferociously for over an hour at the impact point to melt steel, melting point about double the maximum combustion temperature of the fuel, still have enough left over to pour down the elevator shaft and start similarly destructive fires all through the building. This kerosene really is remarkable stuff. How chilling to realize that those kerosene heaters we had in the house when I was a kid with deadly bombs just waiting to go off. One false move and the entire street might have been vaporized. And never again will I take kerosene lamps out camping. One moment you're there, innocently holding the lamp. The next, vaporized into nothing along with the rest of the campsite and leaving enough of the deadly stuff to start a massive forest fire. These wackos are actually claiming that the raging inferno allegedly created by the miraculously recycling and impossibly hot burning kerosene melted or at least softened the steel from ports of the skyscraper. Oblivious to the fact that the smoke coming from the World Trade Center was black, which indicates an oxygen starved fire, therefore not particularly hot, they trumpet an alleged temperature in the building of 2,000 feet. Without a shred of evidence to support this curious suspension in the laws of physics. Not content with this ludicrous garbage, they then contend that as the steel frame softened, they came straight down instead of buckling and twisting and falling sideways. Since they're already re-engineered the combustion qualities of jet fuel, violated the second law of thermodynamics, and redefined the structural properties of steel, why then would that thing, like the laws of gravity, get in the way? The tower fell in a time almost identical to that of a free-falling object, dropped from that height, meaning that it's physically impossible for it to have collapsed by the method of the top floors smashing the lower floors. But, according to the conspiracy theorists, the laws of gravity were temporarily suspended on the morning of September 11th. It appears that the evil psychic power of those dreadful Arabs knew no bounds. Even after they were dead, they were able, by the power of their evil spirits, to force down the tower and be physically impossible under the laws of gravity. Had it been meeting any resistance from fireproof steel structures, originally designed to resist many tons of hurricane force wind, as well as the impact of a Boeing jet straying off course. Clearly, these conspiracy nuts never did their science homework at school, but did become extremely adept at inventing tall tales for why. Muslim terrorists stole my notes, sir. No, miss, the kerosene here blew up, and vaporized everything in the street, except for my passport. You see, sir, the school bus was hijacked by Arabs who destroyed my homework because they hate our freedom. Perhaps he misunderstood the term creative science and mistakenly thought that coming up with such rubbish was in fact their science homework. The ferocious heat generated by this ghastly kerosene was, according to the conspiracy theorists, the reason why so many of the World Trade Center victims can't be identified. DNA is destroyed by heat, although 3,000 C isn't really required. 100 C would generally do the job. This is quite remarkable, because according to the conspiracy theorists, the nature of DNA suddenly changes if you go to a different city. That's right. If you're killed by an Arab terrorist in New York, your DNA will be destroyed by such temperatures. But if you're killed by an Arab terrorist in Washington, D.C., your DNA will be so robust that it can survive temperatures which completely vaporized a 65-ton aircraft. You see, these Marines have somehow concocted the idea that the missile which hit the Pentagon was not a missile, but one of the hijacked planes. And to prove this unlikely premise, they point to a propaganda statement from the Bush regime, which rather stupidly claims that all but one of the people aboard the plane were identified on the site by DNA testing, even though nothing remains of the plane. The plane was vaporized by the fuel tank explosion, maintaining safely, but the people inside it were all but one identified by DNA testing. So there we have it. The qualities of DNA are different depending upon which city you're in, or perhaps depending upon which fairy story you're trying to sell at any particular time. This concoction about one of the hijacked planes sitting in the Pentagon really is a howler. For those not familiar with the layout of the Pentagon, it consists of five rings of buildings, each with a space in between. Each ring of building is about 30 to 35 feet deep, with a similar amount of open space between it and the next ring. The object which penetrated the Pentagon went in at about a 45-degree angle, punching a neat circular hole of about 12 feet in diameter through three rings, six walls. A little later, a section of wall about 65 feet wide collapsed in the outer ring. Since the plane, which the conspiracy theorists claim to be responsible for the impact, had a wingspan of 125 feet and a length of 155 feet, and there was no wreckage of the plane, either inside or outside the building, and the lawns outside were still smooth and green enough to play golf on, this crazy delusion is clearly physically impossible. And hey, we've already disregarded the combustion qualities of jet fuel, the normal properties of common building materials, the properties of DNA, the laws of gravity, and the second law of thermodynamics. What the hell? Why not throw in a little spatial impossibility as well? I would have thought that the observation that a solid object cannot pass through another solid object without leaving a hole, at least as big as itself, is reasonably sound science. But the conspiracy theorist is mumbo-jumbo. It conflicts with the delusion they're hooked on. So it must be wrong. Although trying to get them to explain exactly how it could be wrong is a futile endeavor. Conspiracy theorists fly into a curious panic whenever the Pentagon missile is mentioned. They nervously maintain that the plane was vaporized by its exploding fuel load and point to the World Trade Center crash as evidence of this behavior. That's a wonderful fruit loop. Like an insect which is just being sprayed, running back and forth in its last mad death throes. They first argue that the reason the hole is so small is that the plane never ends the wall, having blown up outside. And then suddenly that's what deflating the 250-foot-deep missile hole by saying that the plane disappeared all the way into the building and then blew up inside the building, even though the building shows no signs of such damage. As for what happened to the wings, here is where they get really creative. The wings snapped off and folded into the fuselage, which then carried them into the building, which then closed up behind the plane like a piece of meat. Since then, they also claimed that the plane flew on its belly, ignoring the undamaged lawn. while at the same time citing alleged witnesses to the plane diving steeply into the building from an irrecoverable angle. How they reconcile these two scenarios as being compatible is truly a study in stupidity. Once they get desperate enough, you can be sure that the UFO conspiracy stuff will make an appearance. The Arabs are in league with the Martians. Space aliens snatched the remains of the Pentagon plane and fixed most of the hole in the wall just to confuse people. They gave the Arabs invisibility pills to get them onto the plane. Little green men were seen talking to Bin Laden a few weeks prior to the attack. As the nation gears up to impeach the traitor Bush and stop his perpetual oil war, it's not helpful to have these idiots distracting from the process by spreading silly conspiracy theories about mythical Arabs, stories which do nothing but play into the hands of the extremist Bush regime. At a less serious time, we might tolerate such crackpots with amused detachment, but they need to understand that the treachery that was perpetrated on September 11th and the subsequent war crimes committed in retaliation are far too serious for us to allow such frivolous self-indulgence to go unchallenged. Those who are truly addicted to conspiracy delusions should find a more appropriate outlet for their paranoia. It's time to stop looming conspiracy theories about September 11th.
Peggy, that was...
By Gerard Holmgren, 2003. Mm-hmm.
Precocious, brilliant, perceptive, and a very nice way to conclude our memorial in his honor, Peggy. Thank you so much for reading that.
Thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host, concluding our five-part memorial to Gerard Holmgren. I want to thank you all for listening.